It's the first Monday of the month, and that means Maine Calling checks in with legislative leaders in Augusta. The snow falls and the snow melts, and the rivers rise, and the work of the legislature goes on. The session is in full swing with public hearings and work sessions in every committee. Among the bills being considered, one to reduce the size of the Maine Arts Commission, proposals to reinstate the tip credit as part of the minimum wage law, bills regulating open pit mining in Maine, and of course, Real ID. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we get an update with two legislative leaders, Republican Senator Andre Cushing of Newport, who is Assistant Senate Majority Leader, and Democratic Representative Jared Golden of Lewiston, Assistant House Majority Leader. What are your questions for legislative leadership? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From Maine Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. How closely have you been paying attention to the current legislative session? Are you happy with the issues your legislators are focusing on? Well, today is your chance to speak with two legislative leaders. Joining me in our Augusta studio, Senator Andre Cushing, a Republican from Newport, the Assistant Senate Majority Leader, and Representative Jared Golden, a Democrat from Lewiston, the Assistant House Majority Leader. As always, we want to hear from you. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Thank you both for being here on Maine Calling today in our Augusta studio. I want to start by saying I was chatting with Mal Leary, a State House reporter, before I came on the air, and he tells me that the weather has put things behind a little bit, that the legislature was hoping to have 60% of the bills out of committee by this Friday, and you are no longer on pace to have that happen. So what does that mean? What are the implications of falling behind? It's not like a school district in which you can keep adding days, is it?
Well, thank you for having us on, Jennifer. It's always good to be back. And to, I guess, put this in perspective, I just got a report this morning, which Jared may also have seen, and it's prepared by the nonpartisan staff that does the policy work for us. And they are very good at tracking bills. And right now, we're actually ahead of pace of where we were 2 years ago. We're on par with where we were in the 125th and 126th legislature. And
so how were we doing 2 years ago?
Well, we were probably slightly behind at that point. But we also have 300 more bills this year than we did last session. Mm. So there's some ebbs and flows, and I don't know if Jared wants to chime in on his end, because it is interesting. We have the divided government, so we have Senate chairs on the Republican side and House chairs on the Democratic side.
Well, Jennifer, I think I would say that for starters, the flow of the legislature I kind of see as a bit of a triangle. So, you know, we go through a pretty unique public hearing process with all of our bills. Every bill gets a public hearing. Those hearings take a long time. So generally what you see is a slower moving legislature early on. And then all of a sudden things really start to speed up as these bills come out of the committees and hit the House and Senate floor, and the pace picks up at that point. So I'm not concerned that we're too far behind to get our work done. Certainly there is a need to stay focused. We've got about 2.5 months to go. These are important issues, and I hope we're going to stay focused on the issues that matter most to people. So.
Okay, well, the big issue, the big kahuna, is the state budget. Where are we with the state budget? Silence.
We're in process. And just so people put it in perspective, we did pass a supplemental budget a couple
That's
weeks
right.
ago. And that is because if we do nothing else in this building, we have to
pass a budget.
That's constitutionally obligated. If we do nothing else, if we pass no other legislation, we are obligated by the oath we take to the Constitution to have a balanced budget at the end of every year. So now we're dealing with the biennial, which means the two-year budget. The biennial will start July 1st because our fiscal year does, and it will go through till June 30th of next year, and then the following budget will be part of what we work on. But to that end, we will always have course corrections because we're using estimates. So I think that There are some big issues in there, which you may want us to talk about. But ultimately, the process is moving, I think, fairly well, considering the scope of what has to be done.
I'm going to agree on that. You know, the budget proposal from the governor was put out. The committees have been working through that proposal and putting report outs to the Appropriations Committee, and we're really just reaching a point now where I think the Appropriations Committee is rolling up their sleeves and getting to work on what that's going to look like come the end of June, hopefully.
Okay, some of the more specific proposals. The governor says we are not moving, that you are not moving fast, you the legislature, fast enough on real ID. Jared, I know that you had I don't know if an alternative measure is the right way to characterize it, but you did put a measure out that is related to this bill. Why don't you bring us up to speed on what's going on with that?
Right. So, you know, the first thing I want to say, Jennifer, is I didn't put my bill in as a direct response to the larger issue of real ID compliance as a state. Put it in because in December of this year, the Department of Veterans Affairs had sent out a mailer to a number of veterans living on the border of New Hampshire telling them that they were not going to be able to get into this facility where they go for their health care as a result of our state not being real ID compliant. You know, my bill would resolve this short-term problem that these veterans are facing now.
It would have provided passport cards to this group of veterans, this specific group of veterans.
Well, it still could. The governor has vetoed it, and we're going to have a decision as you know, first in the House and then in the Senate on whether or not to override that veto. I think that we should solve this problem now for these veterans rather than waiting to see what's going to happen with the larger issue of real ID. But I would also say that the chairs of the committee set that particular bill up almost in a way where you just can't go wrong. So the money is either going to help these veterans get these IDs that they need to go to their healthcare appointment. And if by chance we become compliant as a state and this problem is resolved, well, then the money would just go to an account for veterans experiencing financial hardship. That's an account that the governor has requested $375,000 for. So really, this just seems like a win-win situation, and I'm hoping we'll override that veto.
Okay, Andre, let's look at the bigger issue, which is the real ID. Maine is one of four states that has not been in compliance with real ID because of privacy concerns that came from both sides of the aisle. But now it looks as though there are going to be real implications for Maine people, for travel, for example, for, you know, military veterans, if we don't pass it. Do you believe a real ID bill will pass? And if so, when?
It's a good question. I think there has been bipartisan support on this. There has also been bipartisan resistance to it. And part of that goes to a philosophy of people on various ends of the philosophical spectrum that are concerned about information being aggregated in a high-tech age where nothing really is that secure if it's out there. The real ID question comes down to an issue that really evolved post 9/11, and it comes to the travel and the security of a variety of states using different metrics for issuing driver's licenses. So in Maine, we resisted complying with the real ID that federal law had required, and we got a waiver, but the federal government has extended that to a point where they are now saying everyone must comply. And so we are now down to a smaller pool. There were many other states before that. We're down to a smaller pool of about four states that have not complied. As I understand it, the amended language will give people an option, though. If you want to have the ability to use your Maine license as you would now for travel purposes, you will have to up that to the standards of Real ID, which I believe has a biometric component to it that will store data. If you choose not to, there is an opt-out provision. So if somebody can get a regular Maine driver's license as they have now without the biometrics and the higher standards, they just will have to have alternative means of ID if they are traveling on a plane, if they're going to a federal institution. And I think that is a reasonable compromise that most people can get behind so that we can reach this point where it's not an overall problem for people. It will be expensive, though. The Secretary of State's office has indicated, I think it's about a $2 million price tag to comply with federal real ID.
Do we have any idea when the vote might happen?
We don't know yet. That's a bill that was sponsored by a senator, so it's going to originate in the Senate first. I'm not sure that it has been reported out of the committee amended yet.
I think that there may have been some language work that was being done, and I don't have the actual status of it, but I know that leadership in both houses and the sponsor, Senator Bill Diamond, have been working diligently to get awareness of the sensitivity. Now, right at this point, the federal government has instituted those protocols, those requirements for federal installations. So any federal bases, which would include PEAS for medical purposes, accessing the PX and other services on base, you must have a form of approved ID, general passport, to get there. This is also affecting contractors who do work on bases, delivery drivers who come to bases. If you go to Washington, D.C. now, they've started to implement this for use in many of the federal buildings where people are going for training for first responder and other purposes. So it's created some complications in the first wave, and I think we're trying to work through that.
I think an important note, Jennifer, is that in regard to these federal facilities, having possession of a waiver doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to relax their new standards for gaining access to these facilities. It's going to be the actual possession of a real ID compliant form of ID. And so, the concept that just passing this bill is going to resolve this immediate problem for those who are being denied access to federal facilities is not quite right. And I think people need to understand that even if we take that vote to comply, actual implementation in the beginning of an issuance of a real ID compliant main license could take many months, if not more than a year.
The governor has asked the legislature to turn his welfare regulations and rules into permanent law. Is that going to happen, Jared?
I think it probably depends on a case-by-case basis, which of those proposals are we talking about. We're absolutely on board with the idea that there should be no waste, fraud, and abuse of any kind with any kind of government program. So, I think we're willing to have a conversation about those particular issues that are going to prevent, those money that's being set aside to help people that need that help from being wasted, and making sure that it goes, directly to people who need the help and is, delivered to them in a way that's going to help them improve their lives and get into a position in life where they're ready to, be successful and take care of themselves.
Andre, is this idea in a bill form?
I believe there's some legislation that's being crafted. I can't say that it's out as of yet because I've not directly followed that. But I think part of this that we need to reflect on is this is not about punishing people who need a safety net. This is about creating an attitude and atmosphere within the state that welfare is not a lifestyle. It is a means to support people who are in difficult points in their life and then need to move on. And I think the governor, through some of the programs DHHS has put into place, particularly those in collaboration with the Department of Labor, where they have, as you've seen in Portland, located Department of Labor career centers next to the welfare offices. So when you come in, one of the first questions is, do you have a job? Are you looking for a job? And then they transition them over. It's part of a process. It's part of a transition from what may, in some people's cases, have been a multi-generational lifestyle. And so I think as we look at how we put this in law, we also need to look at the pathway out. If there are obstacles for people who need a little more time or a little more help, we need to create those flexibilities while looking at people who abuse the system and recognize they're taking valuable assets from people who may really need them.
This past weekend, I believe it was Friday, your Senate president has called on the Republican Party and some Republicans to stop making personal attacks against Democrats, including the House Speaker. Do you agree with Mike Thibodeau that we need to change the tenor?
I agree that since before November 8th, but particularly since November 8th, there has been a level of really demeaning discussions and infighting that takes away from the important issues we have here. And from that standpoint, I agree with the Senate president. We have had numerous discussions within our caucus. about the weariness we are having with individual attacks, continued expansion of some of the campaign debate, some of the sort of gratuitous comments in social media and commentary that really demean the work that we as elected officials are obligated to pay attention to. Now, we're in the adult season here, where the type of issues that have been brought up have had their say, and it's now time to move on and deal with things like the opioid crisis, deal with the question of what affects our tourism industry, the tip credit, to address the issue of education funding and the serious impact that another 3% income tax has on professional couples and individuals we need to attract to Maine. Those are the serious questions. Whether somebody did or didn't file paperwork, whether somebody did or did not get the proper vetting or whatnot, have your say and move on, okay? That's what we need to do now.
Jared, in all my years of reporting in Maine, state legislative leaders have really prided themselves on ability to be bipartisan and civil and act in you hear over and over again, this is not Washington, D.C., this is Augusta, Maine. Is it more difficult this year than it has been in the past?
Absolutely, and I think it's getting harder and harder every year. I'm very thankful of the leadership that Mike Thibodeau has shown by stepping forward to call on an end to the personal attacks and calling for a refocus on the work that we all know we've been sent here to do and staying focused on how we can help improve Maine. I think that, you know, the national partisan division is growing, and how we interact with one another as elected officials here in the State House can set the tone and set the example of how we can work together to get things done, or it could set the tone in a very negative way. I don't have any interest in doing that. I know Andre doesn't, and, you know, we're really here to focus on what can we do for the state of Maine in this next couple of months and with a budget that we're going to pass for the next 2 years.
Andre mentioned the state's opioid crisis. The Portland Press Herald Maine Sunday Telegram is wrapping up an astonishing 10-part series on just the depth of this crisis and the difficult policy decisions that you all now face. What is before you right now that is a workable solution? At the end of this legislature, are we going to see meaningful change and meaningful progress in the opioid crisis?
Well, I chair with Representative McCrate the new task force that was just appointed, and it's different than a committee. We will not be hearing public testimony on legislation. We will be bringing in a number of people who have experience outside of the legislature, doctors, people who run treatment facilities, people in law enforcement, and we will be looking at what has been done to date from a collaborative report that was done last May. And we'll be looking to build on the things that have worked well and fill in the gaps of what hasn't been done. I think what Representative McCrate and I have both agreed to is right now we don't know what we don't know. We do know the things that are out there. We know about the increase in opioid-related deaths. We know about the increased use of naloxone. We know the cost to society in the loss of people either through addiction, which is draining their energy and resources, or sadly their death. And now we need to look at what policy measures we take. There are things that are being done in communities and in regions very effectively. We need to see if we can build on those. We need to see if we can support those. And sadly, we're not going to solve the problem here in Augusta. It's going to be done in localities. It's going to be done by people in communities stepping up and taking a part in this.
What is the timeline for the task force? When do you hope to be done? And then when the task force has completed its work, do you propose legislation as a task force? You said it's different than a committee.
Yeah, a task force is made up of a certain number of legislators and a certain number of public members, non-elected. So what we will do is have an interim report of what we feel our priorities should be by April 30th. And then we will take time over the summer and into the fall to complete our study and report back to the legislature with some potential proposals.
That's fast.
Yeah, you know, I think that the roots of this crisis is in part, you know, originates with our economic downturn in 2007. There's just so much frustration out there and a loss of hope for a lot of people that have lost their jobs and lost their way of life and are struggling to get by. You know, early on in this legislative session, we asked our caucus members to tell us what some of their top concerns were. And this is the, you know, one of the top crises, you know, issues that they wanted to address. I think that there's bipartisan agreement that this is a real problem. It's a serious problem. Too many people are dying. I think it's an all hands on deck type of issue. We gotta do everything that we can. We are absolutely committed to putting more money into treatment and prevention. You know, and I think when you know that more than, you know, we got more than one a day dying to this issue, we're gonna, you know, we're willing to take steps now and then continue to plug away at this issue. Every cycle, you know, we keep coming back and doing a little bit more, but.
You know. Well, we do have to take a break. When we come back, your comments and questions. We're with Legislative Leadership in Augusta. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do the law firm of Eaton Peabody's Startup Group, working to provide nimble counsel in a fast-paced world. And Freemasons in Maine, supporting Maine Public Radio's efforts to provide knowledge, wisdom, and entertainment to the people of Maine.
If we have the technology, why don't self-driving cars take over now? Turns out, humans are still getting the hang of them.
It may be the most complex activity that most adults on the planet engage in.
I'm Ari Shapiro. Uber is testing autonomous vehicles in Pittsburgh. We take a ride in one and see how the experiment is going this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 each weekday evening right here on Maine Public Radio. Do you value and appreciate public broadcasting? Lend your voice in support of this valued service. Participate in our I Love Maine Public testimonial campaign, designed to raise awareness of what Maine Public means to Maine and its citizens. You can be a big part of this initiative, and all it takes is a minute of your time. We have an I Love Maine Public hotline, photo opportunities, and a written and verbal testimonial vault. There are any number of fun ways for you to join in. Please go to mainepublic.org to see all the ways that you can participate. Thank you.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the latest news from the legislative session. In the Augusta studio with me, Representative Jared Golden. He's a Democrat from Lewiston and the Assistant House Majority Leader. Also here, Senator Andre Cushing, a Republican from Newport and Assistant Senate Majority Leader. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We're going to start in Saco with Stephen. Hi, Stephen. Go ahead.
Yeah, bill that's been submitted now. It's Bill LD-758. It's an act to provide free admission for permanently disabled persons at Maine State Parks. And I urge all your listeners to call their representative and support it. And I was wondering if you have any comments on it. It was submitted by Representative Donna Bailey from Saco.
Have you all been following this bill?
Not as closely as the caller has.
Stephen, do you know if this has had a public hearing yet?
I know it's been submitted to the Reference Committee of Agriculture, Conservation, and Forestry. I don't know if it's had a hearing yet. Of course, we want to get it out of committee and sent to the floor. The national parks will admit a handicapped person and a caretaker for free. And I thought that'd be a nice thing to do for handicapped people and veterans, of course, anybody who's disabled on the Maine State Parks.
Okay. Thanks for your call, Stephen.
Well, Jennifer, I'll say, you know, Representative Bailey is in my caucus. You know, I made that connection that the caller did to, you know, veterans. We have a lot of disabled veterans, a lot of programs out there that are meant to get them outdoors living, you know, the best healthy lives that they can. And I think that this is, you know, a bill that comes in that same vein. So interested to see how it goes in the public hearing. And thank Representative Bailey for bringing it forward.
Thank you, Stephen, for your call. We'll move on. We'll go to Portland and Adam. Hi, Adam. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hello. Hello, Representative Golden. First, I want to thank you for your service. My father and I both served in the military, and it's great to see the veterans and service members are being represented in Maine. My question is, why did LaFitte veto this bill? To me, it looks very clean cut. It seems like it's widely supported on both sides. is there some unforeseen impact that only LePage is seeing, or is some kind of political move that's just disregarding veterans? I want to know which insight you guys had as to why that, why you did that, and also what can I do as a mayor to help push this bill forward despite LePage's vote? That'd be tough.
Thank you, Adam, and thank you again for your service as well. You know, I don't want to put words in the governor's mouth necessarily. I think that he's suggested that the bill is necessary because what we should do is pass a bill to become compliant with Real ID as an entire state. I think in his letter suggested that this was a carve out for a special group. I would actually agree with him. This is specifically meant to help veterans who are struggling with Real ID right now, as opposed to the rest of the state, where every citizens aren't going to feel the pinch of Real ID compliance until next January. So I think it warrants immediate attention. You know, I think as well that the bill was, as you know, we talked about earlier, the bill has been set up in a way where no matter what happens, it's going to go to benefit veterans, whether it's helping them resolve this ID issue or helping those veterans who might need a little bit of help because they're struggling financially. So, you know, I do hope that we will override that veto. If you want to be helpful with that, I would suggest you should start by making a phone call to your state representative, your state senator, and asking for their support.
All right. Thanks, Adam, for your call. I'm going to move on to Nancy, also calling from Portland. Hi, Nancy. Go ahead.
Hi. On a lighter note, last week the legislature passed a bill authorizing the Commission for Maine's Bicentennial in 2020. The Maine celebration will happen in Augusta. I want other cities and towns to start organizing their own celebration. I hope to obtain a 24-hour-a-week volunteer position with the city of Portland organizing their celebration. But I want the
Nancy,
towns.
Nancy, yeah. You called on the right day because Andre Cushing, who's sitting across from me, is not only a state senator but a history buff. He's smiling, grinning ear to ear as you're talking. Go ahead, Andre.
Nancy, thank you for calling in. This is, for those of us who kind of relish the history of our state, an exciting opportunity to once again highlight what a pivotal role Maine played in so many factors during the 1800s. As many people who reflect on their history remember, we were part of the Missouri Compromise. Missouri came in as a slave state, and Maine was the free state. And it was the amendment that Henry Clay had proposed that allowed for that to happen and sort of keep the balance of parity. As far as this event goes, I've had some conversations with Dave Cheever, the archivist. I know that Secretary of State Matt Dunlap is very involved and is also a passionate guardian and promoter of Maine's history. So I hope that we can use this as a chance to highlight not only the great traditions Maine has, but also we can look to Maine's future and what we want to become as we change. We've gone through some evolutions. We used to be a major shipping state with the tall pines that were used in lumbering and particularly in ship's mast, and then we moved into an industrial sector. And those things have sort of transitioned now, and tourism is a big part of Maine's history, but it still has some great roots in different industries that we need to reflect on.
Nancy, are you hoping that from the legislature there's more than just a proclamation? Is that why you're calling here today?
Well, they have established the rules for the commission, but I'm calling so that the it's going to be held in Augusta, and the centennial celebration was held in Portland. So I'm hoping that the cities and towns, for the centennial, they had their own celebrations, and I'm hoping they will for this bicentennial.
Okay, great. Thanks so much for calling. We'll go to Brooksville and Jody. Hi, Jody. Go ahead.
Yes, I start with the premise that there is arguably no more threatening prospect for the environment than that of metallic mining, which is the subject of several bills in the legislature right now. The DEP has introduced for the third time a bill that would allow industry to mine in Maine, and in addition to the NRCM bill in opposition to it, there's a set of bills introduced by Ralph Chapman that would repeal the problematic bill in effect right now. Also, a bill that would establish a moratorium on metallic mining and a proposal to establish an advisory panel with mining expertise. It was the crisis that took place because of mining resulting in a Superfund site in Harborside back in the 70s that led to the present 1991 rules.
Jody, is your question for our guests whether or not they support these measures and what they believe the status is in the legislature?
Well, we know that what the status is. There are work sessions going on right now, and because NRCM misled a number of environmental groups to support their compromise bill, I am calling to talk about the uncompromising bill, which members of the press don't seem to know about in general. Kevin Miller is one exception to that. But anyone who disagrees with the idea of compromising with the mining industry should alert their groups that are in support of the NRCM bill. That is the essence of it, because it would inevitably lead to acid drainage of the sort that has made the Callahan mine in Brooksville a Superfund site. That would be happening in all of the various other sites in Maine, including Bald Mountain, which is owned by J.R. Irving.
Okay, Jody, let me ask our legislative leaders, is this something, Ryan, Jared, that you're hearing a lot from your constituents?
This is not an issue that I'm hearing from my constituents personally a lot, Jennifer, but I'm not aware of all of the various bills that are before the committee right now. But what I can say is that the mining rules that were proposed in the last legislature were very strongly rejected on a bipartisan vote in the House. I think we had this debate last year, and for me personally, not much has changed, and I anticipate the same outcome.
Thoughts, Andre?
I think that the Environment and Natural Resources Committee over the last 3 to 4 years has had extensive hearing. There clearly was a problem that took place in Brooksville, but it was due to, I think, both poorly developed policies there and maybe some mismanagement. But everyone is aware in that committee of the tremendous implications of this, and I think we've got to respect the work that Senator Saviello and the members of that committee are doing on this issue.
All right. Thank you, Jody, for your call. If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. If you send an email, please make it brief. Tweet, you can tweet at Maine Calling, or you can post to our Facebook page. We have an email from Sandy. We are keenly aware of Maine's need to increase its population of young people and do not want our legislators to neglect them. But as seniors, very seniors, who often attend AARP Tuesdays at the State House, we wonder what bills geared towards seniors, oops, my screen just jumped on me, actually, oh my goodness, I can't read the rest of it. What bills geared towards seniors, I'm going to guess that the rest of the email says, actually have a chance of passing or something like that. What are you looking at that would help senior citizens, Jared?
Well, I think that every year in the budget, we look at programs that we know have traditionally helped our seniors in the state of Maine. Things like drugs for the elderly are always very important. It's not necessarily a bill, but it is a line item in the budget that's very important to seniors, I know. I think that for a lot of our retired seniors dealing with issues in the budget around COLA, cost of living increases, very important to them on a fixed budget. And most importantly, I'd say property taxes. We want to see them go down. For people living on a fixed budget, we don't want to price them out of their homes. We want to address rising property taxes in this legislature and make sure that we are providing direct property tax relief, not only to seniors, but all of our Mainers.
I think a couple of things that come to mind, which may not be as immediate but have an impact, is the tip credit. I've heard from people both in the restaurant industry and folks who have family members who are on fixed incomes that it is causing them concern as to whether that simple pleasure of going out to eat is going to get less available because their fixed income means that if prices rise, they may not be able to go out to eat as often. Likewise, as we look at the effects on people's property taxes, that is a significant factor for those who are remaining in their own home. They may have paid the mortgage off long ago, but with limited means of increasing their income, rising property taxes and costs associated with that home are a concern.
Where are we in the possible change to the minimum wage law that would incorporate a tip credit?
We have public hearings in the Labor Committee this week, so that's the beginning of the process right there. That's going to be a long day for the committee. I'm sure a lot of people are going to come in to talk about that question in its entirety.
All right. Well, we do have to take another quick break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions.
You make Maine calling possible, as do WEX, providing global payment solutions for the fleet, travel, and health industries. Career opportunities at WEXINC.com. And Condo Furniture by Endicott Home, committed to offering eco-friendly furniture for living well in smaller spaces. CondoFurniture.com.
On the next Fresh Air, it's tax time. While many people are still trying to finish their taxes, the Trump administration is trying to move forward on the president's promise to overhaul the tax system. We'll talk taxes with journalist T.R. Reid, author of A Fine Mess, A Global Quest for a Simpler, Fairer, and More Efficient Tax System. Join us.
You can join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock right here on Maine Public Radio. And coming up in just a few minutes at 2 o'clock, we'll have the Commonwealth Club of California. Author and entrepreneur Jerry Kaplan discusses artificial intelligence. That's coming up on the Commonwealth Club of California at 2 o'clock, just a few minutes from now, right here on the stations of Maine Public Radio.
This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, two top legislative leaders with me to discuss how this legislative session is progressive. In the studio with me, Senator Andre Cushing, who's Assistant Senate Majority Leader, and Representative Jared Golden, Assistant House Majority Leader. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Before we go back to the calls, though, why don't I ask each of you what are your personal biggest priorities this session? Jared, you go first.
Well, it's always hard to pick from among, you know, a series of top priorities that I came up here to work on this legislature, but certainly one that I'm going to put a lot of time and effort into is a bill having to do with expanding access to mental health care for veterans in the community, not trying to supplant VA health care, but rather trying to identify in those cases where there's a wait for a veteran to get the care that they need from the VA, what can we as a state do in our communities to make sure that they're getting timely care and not left, you know, in a state of crisis. I think that's when we start to see some veterans get in trouble or it gets right at the issue of trying to prevent suicide. So very near and dear to me and certainly top priority.
What about you, Andre Cushing?
Well, I think the most important thing we're talking about this session is getting Maine at Atlantic Standard Time. That's for Bill Green.
I've known Bill Green for more than 20 years, and he loves to talk about that.
In all seriousness, there are a number of issues that I now serve on two committees, so I'm kind of balancing that out. And the opioid crisis has probably taken front and center for me in how we create a pathway forward for policy decisions and supporting those things that are working. So that's probably the number one thing on my plate. But I also know that the Senate president has a significant bill, LD 1168, which would propose a constitutional amendment for Maine crime victims. We now protect the rights of those who are defendants in a case, and we also respect and protect certain rights of those who are convicted. But sadly, we have found over time that victims of crime sometimes are left swinging in the process. And so we're looking in this bill, it's called Marcy's Law for Maine, to provide a constitutional amendment which would provide some protection, some dignity and respect for the individuals who are the victims of crimes.
You know, I want to say, Jennifer, I've actually had a sit-down personal conversation with Andre about the seriousness of the opiate crisis, but also about the ways in which it touches almost all of us personally. I think at this point it's risen to the level of a crisis where almost everyone knows someone that they care about who's impacted. Andre's shared those stories with me. I've shared some about friends of mine, and I know he cares really deeply about it. So, you know, good to hear that it's a top priority.
Yeah, it's an insidious problem that sucks the life out of a lot of good people, and it's affecting an entire generation in a way that will create lifelong problems for some of them. And in a state where we have an aging population, I think it becomes imperative that we show that drugs of this nature, if they're for medical purposes and they are properly prescribed, they have a place. If they are here for recreational or for some other purpose, most heinous in my mind is those who profit from the drug trade, they're not welcome in Maine. They are creating more problems for us and people that are having their essence sucked out of them.
We're going to go to Portland. And Tom, hi, Tom, go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. I'm a retired teacher, and I'm a grandparent of two young, lovely young granddaughters. And increasingly, I've been concerned about, one, our state's aging population, which is caused to some degree by declining birth rates, and by the frankly the difficulty, the challenges that young families face because it's so expensive, and it seems that our policies for around children are kind of based on a 1950s idea of both family structures and also child development understandings that were not at all up to date, and that for to succeed and have a better future for our state, we really need our young children better taken care of, and the state really needs to step up more. And in the current budget, it seems that or at least the proposed budget, the governor has proposed cutting, really not at all facing this and cutting.
Tom, are you talking about education? Are you talking about child care? What are you talking about?
Child care and early childhood.
Okay.
Learning.
Go ahead, Jared.
Thank you. Well, I think for one, it sounds like you would be a proponent of seeing us make an investment as a state in things like Head Start and pre-K, which negate the need for child care, but also get people an early start towards getting on the right path, educationally speaking. I would agree. I'm concerned. We know that we've seen a spike in childhood hunger in the state in the last 6 years. When we have these conversations about things like welfare, that's certainly where my focus remains, is on helping children and making sure that the welfare reforms that we are able to agree on target that money towards helping children that are in need and not in any way punishing them or leaving them without the help that they need. That rise in childhood hunger is significant, given that it's the opposite trend from the rest of the nation. And it's certainly something that I know we're going to be focusing on, is how can we make sure that kids are getting the support they need to be able to have good opportunities in their life, whether it's being, being fed and safely housed, but also getting a quality education, a public education.
All right. Thanks so much for your call, Tom. I'm going to go to an email from Cindy. She writes, I understand several bills have been introduced to address the backlog of untested rape kits in the state. Will your guests please discuss the content of these bills, their status, any public hearings yet, and what the chances are they will pass during the session? Is this an issue you all are covering, following?
Like many of these things that are particularly important issues, I think the ability for Representative Golden or myself to speak on any particular one is going to be a little challenge, not having the chance to do the research. But I think from my recollection of this bill that there is something, I think, before either criminal justice or judiciary that will be addressing how they will deal with the backlog. It quite candidly comes down to an economic matter in some cases. I mean, rape is clearly an emotional as well as a physical attack, and those people who are dealing with the after effects of that deserve the ability to confront their perpetrators. If it's somebody that's been identified, if they haven't been identified, then law enforcement needs that information. And I think most, if not all of us in the legislature, consider that a priority. to be respectful of the caller, though, we're not going to be able to speak to the actual mechanics of where that is in the process today. But I do know that people who are dealing with those issues in the committees understand and hear from the professionals as to what their needs are, and I hope that, that we'll give it the proper diligence in both committee and in the budget.
I may be wrong, Jennifer, but I think it might be a bill that's been put forward by Representative Dylan Bates from Westbrook. I think everyone would agree that that is certainly a top priority. Sometimes it's a question of, you know, is the capacity there to process the backlog, even if we provide the resources to do so? Or, you know, do we need to build capacity by having enough staff on hand to actually go ahead and do that work too? These are the types of questions that, that the committee will work out, and, you know, hopefully we can find a good resolution that will make some progress towards that.
In fairness to public safety, there is a process to protect the rights of those who may be accused, as well as the rights of the victim. And I think that goes back to, you know, the bill that, that the Senate president has proposed on victims' rights. We don't want to do things hollowly. And if you're talking to criminal justice and they already have a plan in place, us passing another law that implements standards on them that doesn't allow them to do their job properly is not always helpful. So not having been in the hearing, I can't speak to where that ultimately comes out, but I think, as Representative Golden has said, there's an awareness that there are some issues that need to be addressed, and it's been there for a few years now.
Okay, well, we can go to Berwick then, and to Jonathan. Hi, Jonathan, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for your show. I really appreciate it. I'm calling because I'm a passionate educator in our state, and I'm calling about question two. I know that there's that's the Stand Up for Students campaign, and I know that there's been a pretty active effort to repeal it by the Republican Party, and I'd just like to speak to that and to maybe have your guests speak to their thoughts on question two and how, if they oppose question two, how they what they have as a solution for funding our educational system in the state. As we know, the PICUS report that came out in 2013 showed that underfunded education every year in our state about $328 million, and so we clearly have a funding issue in our state. We've been passing tax cuts on the wealthy for the wealthiest Mainers in our state. We've done that twice in the past decade, and those tax cuts are ostensibly subsidized by local property taxpayers. And I continue to hear the tax flight myth argument, which was debunked by the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities, flouted, and I continue to hear really essentially misinformation spread.
So, Jonathan, I'm going to give our guests a chance to respond. You know, Andre Cushing, you've made it clear that you believe the 3% surcharge on income above $200,000 is not a good thing. But what we've discussed on this program before and what other legislative leaders from both parties have told me is that their message was clear to them, that people in Maine want to see education funded. So if it's not for question two, what is it? How do we fund education at the levels that Maine people want us to?
Well, the question becomes, in that context, what people are willing to give up to fund education at the level that they say they want it at. There are priorities that come in any budget. What we are obligated to do is work within the resources to come up with a balanced budget. Now, we can have the discussion about potentially increasing taxes, and there are some things that have come into play here. Amazon has now agreed to start collecting sales tax. Airbnb and other services like that are starting to collect the taxes on
the lodging
services.
Tax, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So there are things that are generating revenue. The proper management of our cash flow has allowed us to borrow less money, so that has freed up some money within the current budgetary constraints that, instead of paying it out in interest, we're now able to use that money more efficiently. That doesn't get to the real question, which has come up over the last 15 years during a Democratic administration in control. It came up, and it's come up again in the budget cycles. How do we fund education at the appropriate level? We I don't know that we've come up with a final solution to that, but I think making policy by referendum has proven to be, in some cases, catastrophic, because people react to that question in the simple 30-second ad, but they don't understand how it affects their lives, their businesses, their families, as the tip credit issue has shown in tourism, and as the 3% is shown with now universities, hospitals, major professional businesses saying they are having people decline to come and work for them in Maine because we are now going to be de facto the second highest tax state in the nation.
You know, Jennifer, I certainly do want to acknowledge that I think we all agree, including, you know, I know Republicans in the Senate agree that people spoke twice now very clearly that they do want the state to pay for 55% of the cost of a public education. And I know that we're going to work together to get there, certainly. You know, the caller referenced all of the tax breaks, income tax mostly, that have been pushed through the last three budget cycles. And I think, you know, suggesting that this is shifting the cost onto property taxpayers. And so the one thing I would, you know, ask that we look into is how does question two stack up to the tax levels that we had in this state in 2009 in regard to the income tax? You know, this is my first go as a legislator with referendum questions having passed at the ballot box. And now here we are in this legislature grappling with these things. And while I would agree that it's not the best way to make policy, I think it is the result of a lack of action to do what people asked us to do, which was fund education. And, you know, for me, I think people looked at the ballot question. They knew that they wanted more school funding. They saw the funding mechanism that was proposed, and they acknowledged that they didn't have the money to pay for it themselves. They wanted the wealthiest people in the state to pay a little bit more. And I think it is a question not only about education but about tax fairness. And you know, I think that has to be part of the discussion here.
Well, that's going to be the last word. Thank you to all of you who called. Thank you, Andre Cushing and Jared Golden, for being here. Jared Golden, the Assistant House Majority Leader, a Democrat who represents Lewiston. Andre Cushing, Assistant Senate Majority Leader, and a Republican who represents Newport. Nikki Shields ran the board today. We had additional help from Dan Works and Mal Leary. Thank you. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our audio archives at mainecalling.net. Maine is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, join me for a conversation about Maine women and their role in the vote in the fight for voting rights. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.